Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail!
Indeed we do.
Boy, howdy. My name is William DeBiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. For the purposes of this particular email, you may call me Rockmeister McCool. You don't have to, but you may.
I think you should. And this is where you control the conversation, right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Here's how it works. You send us a letter. You can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Or you can send us something via snail mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
I object to snail mail.
You don't like snails? I like snails.
Just post. Regular post.
I like knowing that snails are delivering them. They've got like, you know, little bags like, you know, strapped over their shells. It's cute.
I suppose it is slower than email, which is where it got the name.
Right.
But it is plenty hasty, and I want you to support your local post office.
You should. Well, this is one of the reasons why we're encouraging you to write to us at our P.O. Box, which is
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California 90064.
Yeah, and indeed, as you may have noticed, we had some turmoil over the last month or so. I had a health scare, we went on vacation, the sort of clear the cobwebs. So we haven't had We've Got Mail in a little bit, and indeed the mail piled up a smidge.
A little bit.
We got a few things in the PO box.
Speaking of piles, I got one right in front of me here.
We got some stuff from our PO box. Thank you so much to everyone who wrote in advance. But let's start here.
And I have to crinkle it on mic to let you know that it's real paper.
Satisfying.
So, yeah, I got to pull it out of the envelope here.
All right.
That a little bit of a snap to it. Here's a letter from Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Hello, Alan. Thank you for writing in. And it reads: Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool, Rockmeister McCool, no correct or incorrect spelling. They're all correct.
However you spell it, that's right.
I've enjoyed Holy Batman, and I don't envy you having to make your way through all of the new adventures of Batman. I checked it out, and Batmite is just marginally less annoying than Scrappy-Doo.
Wow. Well, at least it's better than Scrappy-Doo.
Lenny Weinrib was the name of the actor who played Scrappy-Doo, and he is one of the main voice actors on Batman. But he does not play Batmite, strangely enough.
Interesting enough. We'll talk about this in a second.
On the subject of comic books, I've been reading my way through the first 63 issues of The Fantastic Four this year.
Oh.
By reading The Essential Fantastic Four, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. I haven't read many of these issues before. I thought I would write in with some random observations. I'm also reading War and Peace this year. I prefer Fantastic Four. But what's the difference, really?
Hey, Fantastic Four was the world's greatest comics magazine. Did anyone call War and Peace the world's greatest comics magazine?
It's frequently on lists of the greatest works of literature ever written.
But was it considered the world's greatest comics magazine?
No, not the world's greatest comics magazine.
I'm just saying, you can't take that away from Fantastic Four.
I suppose not.
Yeah, it's got one thing. It's got at least one thing over War and Peace.
First, Stan Lee wanted to create superheroes who were more like regular people. Stan Lee has said in interviews that his goal wasn't to like revolutionize anything. He was just bored.
Well, he's actually kind of like, I'm trying to get fired. He was basically like, we need to come up with like our own version of a Justice League. So do a superhero comic with a bunch of a team. And he was like, fine. Okay. They have no secret identities. The hero is a nerd instead of a hunk. One of the characters is a monster, and everyone's scared of how he looks.
And they fight a lot.
They're a family, and they're famous, and they deal with being a celebrity. These are all things that were not supposed to work, and they all work perfectly.
That meant no secret identities. People argued with one another, etc. But there was one way in which he did not have his finger on the pulse of the comic buying public. He wanted to do the Fantastic Four with no special costumes, just street clothes. The first two issues and part of the third, the Fantastic Four, are in street clothes.
Yep.
I understand that everyone wrote in how much they loved the Fantastic Four, but every letter said the same thing: put them in colorful costumes or the deal's off. Not many grown men have a desire to wear tights and a cape, but kids get a kick out of wearing these costumes. It is projecting yourself into a superhero body, you want the fun outfit.
I think they made it work though, because I always felt like the Fantastic Four costumes weren't supposed to be like cool costumes; they were like work outfits.
Yeah,
they were like work outfits, and like the whole idea is like, we do this stuff when we're doing our science stuff. These are science clothes, like a lab coat,
right?
You know, like so. I think they mostly got away with it.
Second, and probably the best issue, This Man, This Monster.
Oh, I love this book
so much. Is as powerful now as it was when I first read it.
It's my favorite comics ever.
This is the one in which the bad guy takes over the identity of the Thing in order to attack Reed Richards, one of the few comics in which a bad guy actually realizes that he is a bad guy.
Yeah.
All the ways in which people rationalize away altruistic behavior vanish for him, like the idea that people do good things for glory or adulation. He realizes that Reed Richards is performing a dangerous experiment to help protect planet Earth, and he's not doing it for glory, because no one even knows he's doing it. What's especially interesting about this issue is that none of the Fantastic Four used their powers this time, except for Johnny Storm, who flamed on his thumb just to prove to someone who he was, but that was it.
Yeah. If you've never read This Man, This Monster, it is really one of the best, like, single issues of a comic ever. And yeah, that's it. This bad guy takes over.
These are all from the 60s.
Yeah, this is from the original early era where Stan Lee and Jack Kirby did every issue of this early run of Fantastic Four, like over 100 issues. One of the issues was a guy, a villain we'd never met before, just he hated Reed Richards. He resented him and his success. Took over the Thing's body, and he was going to kill Reed Richards. And then Reed Richards and the Thing ended up getting stuck inside this awesome dimension that Jack Kirby drew this. I don't even know how the hell he did it. Like, it looks like fucking phenomenal. And then Reed Richards actually tries to sacrifice himself to save Ben Grimm, thinking the Thing was still his friend. He probably would have done it anyway. And the guy realizes, oh, I'm the asshole here. And so he saves Reed Richards. No one will ever know of his sacrifice. No one will ever know that he is actually, like, did something to redeem himself, but that was enough.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a good book. Such a good story. I love that story so much.
Third, The Thing was a public menace. Get me pictures of that menace.
Yeah.
Whenever a story started with some beautiful or valuable object brought in, you could be sure that the Thing was going to destroy it in one of his temper tantrums.
Yeah.
At one point, a cab driver said something he didn't like, so he impaled the cab driver on a lamppost with the cab driver in it.
He went the cab, not the cab driver.
But the cab. He went the cab.
He didn't impale the guy.
That would have been better.
No
one was hurt. Too bad.
Yeah.
But this was wanton destruction of private property. This should have been raised as an issue in the comic. The Hulk at least had diminished mental capacity as an excuse, but Ben Grimm was a pilot and a college graduate.
Well, yeah, we also got to appreciate that Ben Grimm was deeply traumatized by the accident that turned him into a monster, and he is having trouble dealing with what he considers, you know, you can look at, oh, he has superpowers, but to him, it's a disability. It actually prevents him from doing many ordinary things. Mm. It makes people terrified of him in the street. He's lashing out. It's easy to sympathize with his plight, even though he's clearly doing the wrong thing. And I like that complexity of the Thing. But yeah, fair enough. He's a menace. He's definitely someone should tell him to stop doing that. I agree with that. He should be in therapy, but that's a separate thing.
I also got a DVD of the first Fantastic Four cartoon series from 1967. It was really like super limited animation, barely moved at all.
Basically just panel for panel recreations of the comics.
Yeah,
but
more
or less. The comics were good, so they're still
with,
fun.
With like fun, chintzy music.
I really like those.
Which I remember watching as a kid. Yes, I am that old.
Me too.
Most of the episodes were taken from issues of the comic, and it was interesting to see some of the liberties taken. In the Galactus saga, the wounded Silver Surfer was originally taken in and cared for by Alicia, Ben Grimm's blind girlfriend. But in the cartoon version, that role was taken by Sue Storm. One fewer character to animate.
I see it. It sucks, but whatever.
The Silver Surfer wanted to know why she would care for someone who had come to help destroy the planet, and she said to him, quote, "You don't understand. You are important, as is every living thing on Earth. Life is a precious gift. It should not be taken. It's not for us to take. And so we protect it, fight for it, even if the life of a being from another world, even a being who would destroy us, must be helped." This is not taken verbatim from Stan Lee, but it was definitely inspired by his writing. I think this is pretty damn good writing for a Hanna-Barbera cartoon from the 60s.
Yeah.
It makes one wonder if it was canceled before an acceptable time period had elapsed, but that's not for me to judge. This is Alan signing off.
I'm not sure how long that series lasted, because what happened was they had this series of Marvel comics, but it was depending on what episode you watch, it could be Fantastic Four, it could be Daredevil, it could be Iron Man, it could be Submariner, I think, once or twice. Maybe he was just the villain. But regardless, and it was all of that show was great. I loved that show. Even as a kid, there were better animated shows on when I was on. This show was only on in reruns. That show was cool.
The Fantastic Four had, like, the that corny optimism of like a Star Trek.
Yeah.
Or Rod Serling was a little bit bitter about the world, but you watch The Twilight Zone, a lot of the stories are actually quite uplifting.
Yeah.
He actually did have an optimistic streak in him.
Well, there's a certain spiritual uplift, I think, to a lot of them, even if the world around us is very cynical. Mm. Yeah, there's really beautiful stuff in The Twilight Zone. But no, Fantastic Four was just... It's kind of like Doctor Who, you know? It's like kind of a weird setup, but like once you've set it up, you've got characters you can put in any situation. And like literally any situation. Yeah. You can put them in a real life day-to-day scenario. Just here's what the Fantastic Four do on Christmas. Yeah, you've got a story. You can have them meet a god who eats planets. You still got a story. You can have them meet, I don't know, the alligator men. And like you've got a story. Like it doesn't really matter what they do. They're interesting in any situation. And the situation can be as creative as you want.
Were there really alligator men?
There probably were.
I'm sure there were
at some point. There was at some point.
A friend of mine said she once told me that she really liked the Fantastic Four because they're the only superhero team that also functions perfectly well as like a sitcom.
Yeah.
Like you could have like a three wall set sitcom of a living room and just have the Fantastic Four in it and you would still have stories out of their interactions.
The one exception I would take to that actually is, and this is something I miss from the comics, or like the movies never did this right. Yeah. The X-Men used to be like that too. There used to be stuff, just issues of the X-Men hanging out. And one of the things they would do is they would like play baseball in their backyard and stuff. And like Nightcrawler would play all the bases simultaneously, that kind of thing. There were more moments like that. There was more regular interaction.
In the second X-Men movie, there were a couple scenes like
that. A few, like early on. And then the plot kicks in and they don't have any time for it anymore. Like, I kind of wish there had just been a little bit more of that. Mm. The New Mutants had a little bit of that, but that movie's kind of a mess.
Yeah.
Because like, they don't have anything to fight, but like watching them watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer isn't maybe as interesting as they thought it was.
One of the characters in that movie has like this really weird assemblage of powers. It's all really unclear, that movie. Anyway, we also have not just
there's a letter.
But
and also
a
some
big
stuff.
Bubble mailer with big some package. Stuff in it.
It's two books.
It's two books. I'm guessing there's one for each of us. Thank you. This is called a book by Craig M. Farnham called Pazuzu's Wings, An Analysis of Exorcist II, The Heretic, and Other Underappreciated Films.
Yes. Read the letter. This is
and, exciting. And open it up. You'll see that it's signed by Craig M. Farnham.
Thank you, Craig. But read this letter. This is actually really exciting.
This is from Craig. Craig M. Clawdcat Farnham. Clawdcat was the cat tortured by Hubie and Birdie in the old Chuck Jones cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
This reads, Dear Bugs and Daffy, your recent episodes about your favorite Looney Tunes have been a lot of fun. Thank you for making me smile while at work. Well, I know that you've expressed not being too impressed by Hanna-Barbera, I'd be curious to know if there are any of their cartoons that you've enjoyed. But that's not the main reason for my writing you. Number one, I can't wait to hear Whitney crinkle the paper. There we go. There's the paper. The one you set pen to. And number two, roughly a year ago, I sent you an email on which I admitted that I enjoy Exorcist II, The Heretic, and that I was actually writing something on the subject. Well, here we are several months and many pages later, and I wanted to send you copies of the first finished product.
This is amazing.
Most especially, I hope you read the book's dedication and know that I mean every syllable. From Waterbury, Connecticut, I'm sending you a geographically distant but 100% heartfelt hug and great big thank you for all you do. Always, Craig M. Clawdcat Farnham. Second thought, maybe I'm Yosemite Sam.
Whitney, read the dedication.
I love Heretic 2. Varmint. Let's see. Dedication. Oh my goodness. I'm going to cry. The author would like to express his deep appreciation for William Bibbiani and Whitney Seibold, the hosts of the critically acclaimed network of podcasts. They are two profoundly insightful critics who have more than simply entertained me for several years now. They inspired this book. It is because of them and their oft-repressed belief that everyone's a critic that this CT movie buff felt that he had some ability to discuss the world of motion pictures despite making a living that has nothing to do at all with Hollywood or filmmaking. It is admittedly a curious thing to feel when you've come to know people whose voices you hear every day though you've never actually met. We are geographically distant strangers, really, let alone feel indebted to them. But the writer of the following pages wishes to acknowledge that without their example, though the inspiration for this book might have been there, the confidence to write it would not have been. Thank you very much, Bibbs and McCool. And there's also an additional dedication.
Here, read the whole thing. Give credit where credit is due.
And a big thank you to my friend Mark T. Weathersby, who over many years helped me find the language with which to discuss films beyond I liked / hated that. He is a fellow lover of the horror genre who introduced me to some truly awful movies and whose humor is, I will no doubt, will no doubt continue to be infectious.
That's one of the nicest things anyone's ever done for us.
Express how flattered I am by that.
That means a lot.
Insanely wonderful.
That means a lot. Thank you so much for the kind thoughts.
I will definitely read this.
It is an honor to think that we had anything to do with this, and we will treasure these books.
I'm going to look through this book for a second to see some of the things on here. Chapter one is John Boorman, who directed Exorcist 2. Exorcist 2, by the way, is insane. Like it's
oh yeah, like it's nothing to do with anything. It's so fucking weird.
It's quite bad, but it is never not like it weirdly watchable. What a wild music. The idea of Exorcist 2 is that Regan McNeil, who, you know, years after the events of The Exorcist, is brought into this like high-tech science fiction hypnosis lab. And she is brought under hypnosis by this weird machine, and in so doing, like, evokes the demon again. Like, she essentially gets repossessed in retrospect, and they finally put a name to the creature, and it's named Pazuzu.
Yeah, before it was only known as Captain Howdy.
Yeah, and in calling it Pazuzu, it reveals a lot of sort of the racist origins of that story.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird shit going on.
Thing from Africa.
Yeah, it's really messed up. But in any case, Pazuzu's Wings is currently available if anyone else wants to buy it. You can find it on Amazon and other places as well, I assume. But thank you, Craig. That means an absolute lot to us. Like, that's very, very cool. I've never written a book. I can't say that I've had the pleasure.
I started.
My partner has. That's exciting.
Started to write a novel once, for what that's worth.
We've toyed with the idea of writing our own book. Would never really materialize. We have enough on our plate as it is, unfortunately.
Well, thank you, Craig.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
That's so cool.
That's going on my shelf.
Awesome. And then we have one other thing in the mail here.
There doesn't appear to be a letter in this.
There's no letter in it.
It is just a random gift. It is a Blu-ray edition of Rennie Harlan's classic film, Cutthroat Island.
Is there anything more classic than Cutthroat Island? I beg of you.
Cutthroat Island is an interesting... thank you, mysterious fan who sent this to us.
Cutthroat Island.
We appreciate the Blu-ray of Cutthroat Island. Cutthroat Island is a curious case because this was a giant movie. Rennie Harlan put together this thing with Gina Davis. I think she produced it as well. Matthew Modine plays sort of like the dashing hero, but she's like the head pirate. And Frank Langella is the bad guy. Mari Chaykin is in the movie.
It was supposed to be Harrison Ford, and then he dropped out. Mm. So they replaced him with Matthew Modine, you know, the other Harrison Ford.
He's a dashing, handsome movie star
type.
I'm just saying, it's fine.
He's a different actor. That's all I'm saying. He doesn't have the star power, does he?
He never starred in like an Indiana Jones or a Star Wars, so he didn't have that clout behind him.
I'm just saying, more people probably would have gone if Harrison Ford was in it in the 90s. But
Matthew Modine's quite a good actor.
But anyway, it bankrupted a studio.
It was such a bomb. It bankrupted a studio. It lost a huge amount of money. It's one of the biggest bombs in history, and it's kind of curious that we don't talk about it.
No,
and I've
not
always
often.
Found that really odd about the big only
time,
bombs.
The only time we talk about Cutthroat Island is when we talk about movies that lost money.
Yeah, that's it.
It doesn't have like a huge. There's a lot of movies out there where people are just like, "Was it really that bad?" And then all of a sudden, people are talking about why, I don't know, Halloween 3 is good now. It's a fun movie. I'm glad maybe we've overshot that a smidge, but boom. Cutthroat Island doesn't seem to have that. I've never really heard anyone like defend that too forcefully. I've heard some people say it's not as bad as all that, but I've never heard anyone say, no, seriously, that movie is great. I've never heard anyone say that.
Yeah. When a film bombs, the assumption is that it was bad.
Yeah.
It turns out a lot of the bigger bombs that I've seen aren't necessarily bad. They're just a little bit dull. Like, they don't have a lot of personality, and there's not something drawing you back to them. So, same thing for something like Waterworld.
Yeah.
Waterworld is not a terrible movie.
No, it's just sort of fine.
It's got a weird, dumb premise. But yeah, it's just kind of...
It's just kind of okay.
Kind of flat. And I think that's why it was a bomb. If it was really, really bad, there'd be a lot more to talk about.
Agreed.
Same with we reviewed this on a previous podcast. Mars Needs Moms is one of the biggest bombs of all time.
Yeah,
this, motion capture animated film that Disney put out based on this really bizarre book by Berkeley Breathed.
Yeah, and it's not very good.
It's not.
It's got kind of ugly animation, if you ask me. I'm not a big fan of the style, but
yeah, it looks a lot like that movie Monster House. If you ever saw that,
I hate the way Monster House looks. I can't even look at it.
But both of those movies were done with motion capture, which was a little bit more novel when those movies were being made.
Yeah.
And lost a huge amount of money for Disney. Nobody talks about it. In fact, it wasn't even available on a lot of the streaming services for a while. I think they snuck it on kind of recently.
Yeah,
Disney Plus.
Well, they're not proud, that's for sure. regarding the other question that was in there, which is we talked about recently in our
Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Yeah, we talked about our favorite Warner Brothers cartoons, and we could probably do the same with Disney if we really sat down with it. But when it comes down to the best Hanna-Barbera cartoons, are there any Hanna-Barbera cartoons that we love? I'm just going to say it. No.
Hanna-Barbera is a studio.
Yeah.
First of all, I was not allowed to watch the Flintstones. That was,
you mentioned
it
this
was
before, yeah.
Banned in my household. My mom thought it was a sexist show, and she wouldn't let us watch it. For some reason, the Jetsons was okay, even though they're like copies of one another.
Right.
But the reason Hanna-Barbera left such an impact in the world of animation was because of limited animation.
Right.
They developed a way of designing characters and shows so they could be animated quickly. If you're trying to do something like a Bugs Bunny, who's articulated all over and his facial animation
constantly
moving and holding up hands and stuff,
that takes a lot of time.
You have to animate every frame of Bugs Bunny as he moves. If you look at the way Fred Flintstone is designed, you'll notice that he's designed at what they call three quarters. Whereas he's not in profile, he's not facing the camera, he's like sort of turned at three quarters angle.
All you have to do is animate the eyes, and he's looking to the left of the screen, or the right of the screen, or right at the screen, and
you don't have to animate the head. The mouth is surrounded by a separate color.
Yeah.
It's like blocked off. So,
you can just animate
the mouth and replace the cell on just the mouth and keep everything in place.
Yeah.
This allowed animation to move super quick as animation goes. And that was really revolutionary because it allowed animation to be produced on a TV schedule.
Yeah.
They didn't have to do an entire feature film that took years to do. They could just do it on a weekly basis. As such, because they could do that, they made their way into the consciousness. They just, through sheer volume of low-quality content, they were able to fill their coffers. And
most of the stuff, especially the first few decades.
Mm.
Awful.
It's just this cavalcade of shit. It's
like when I was a kid, I watched the Flintstones. It was fine. I watched the Jetsons. It was fine. I watched Yogi Bear. It was fine, I guess.
I never liked Yogi Bear.
I like Yogi Bear. Yogi Bear was on, and I was like, that was okay.
I respect Yogi Bear as like a cultural presence, but I don't really enjoy watching it.
Yeah, I have some affection for a couple of things. And I'm looking at the list right now because I want to make sure I didn't like forget something truly brilliant. And no, I did not. But there's a few things that I have affection for, and I will list them all right here.
All right.
Number one, the earliest one, Hong Kong Phooey. It's not aged well at all, but I just like Scatman Carruthers.
Yeah.
He just had a wonderful voice.
Hong Kong Phooey. Number one super guy.
Yeah, there was this great CD. Remember when they made those? Saturday morning cartoon theme song covers.
Oh, this
from like alt rock bands of like the 90s.
They did this a lot in the 90s. They also did like Schoolhouse Rock Rocks.
Yeah, that one was good.
There was what was it called? I think it was just called I Melt With You. It was like a pop bands doing new wave covers.
Yeah. Honestly, they're all really good. There was like this really badass cover of Johnny Quest that somehow like gradually morphed into Stop the Pigeon from the Snidely Whiplash cartoons. And there was a theme song to Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, which turns out I don't like the show, but the theme song was really, really good when
like
Tripping Daisies covers
the beach,
it.
The
fun album.
It was like Suburban Standard issue if you're like, a teenager in the 90s.
Sublime did a cover on that, didn't they? Remember what they did? But did they do Hong Kong Phooey?
No, they didn't do Hong Kong Phooey.
Hong Kong Phooey was on that.
Let me look up the track list on that CD. Yeah.
But moving on, a couple other things I do have some affection for from Hanna-Barbera. Mostly later stuff. Like, I feel like their attitude, once they started doing less limited animation, they did produce some fun stuff.
Yeah. Here we go. It was put out in 1995. Uh-huh. It was called Saturday Morning, Cartoon's Greatest Hits.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was this... and because of the nature of the record industry in the 90s, they were all long. They had like 20 tracks apiece. But let's see. The track listing was the One Banana, Two Banana from the Banana Splits was done by Liz Phair.
Nice.
Go Speed Racer by Sponge.
Nice.
Sugar Sugar by Semisonic.
Okay.
Scooby-Doo by Matthew Sweet. Josie and the Pussycats by Juliana Hatfield. The Bugaloos by Collective Soul.
Wow.
Underdog by Butthole Surfers.
Nice.
I remember Helmet did a cover of Gigantor, which is pretty great.
That's pretty badass.
The Spider-Man theme song was done by the Ramones.
Yes, and they ended up using that in, I think, one of the Spider-Man movies.
In one of Sam Raimi's movies.
I think somewhere in there, they ended up using the...
Yeah, the Johnny Quest Stop That Pigeon was by the Reverend Horton Heat.
Reverend Horton, yeah, that was a good one.
Open up and let your hearts, and let your... Open up your heart and let the sunshine in, which was
from the Flintstones.
Flintstones.
Yeah, Pebbles.
It was done by this obscure lounge band called Frente. Epop Orc Ah Ah from the Jetsons was done by the Violent Femmes. Fat Albert was done by Dig. A band I don't know called Face to Face did Popeye. Sigmund and the Sea Monsters was Tripping Daisy.
Yeah.
Groovy Ghoulies was the Toadies. Hong Kong Fooey was Sublime. You were
right. Yeah, I was right. Okay, that was a fun cover.
HR Puff and Stuff was done by the Murmurs, and Happy Happy Joy Joy from the Ren and Stimpy Show was done by Wax, and that was contemporary.
That was actually kind of controversial at the time. I was just like, really? Also, I think Ren and Stimpy was on Sundays. I remember thinking that at the time, like, wait a minute. Fuck you. But anyway... a couple other...
I had to list those all, because that's an impressive record.
It's a cool, and if you can find it, definitely track it down. But the couple other things I like, I have some affection for a pup named Scooby-Doo, because they were occasionally a little meta.
Uh-huh.
They actually had some funny bits. They did the Pirates of Darkwater, which was actually really cool. It's one of those ones I've always kind of wanted to cover and cancel too soon, even though it technically had two seasons, because they did actually have like a set storyline. They were going to tell beginning, middle, and end, but they got canceled before they did. But that was a cool action-adventure show. They did SWAT Cats, the Radical Squadron.
Okay, that's just nostalgia talking.
But it was fun, though, and the animation was kind of cool. They did, and then later on, they would do Dexter's Laboratory and the Powerpuff Girls, Johnny Bravo.
When Hanna-Barbera got into the Cartoon Network era and they started producing new original content from...
Yeah.
This was actually... I mean, the Ren and Stimpy show was hugely, hugely influential in that it allowed creator-based cartoons to become a thing.
Yeah.
And so you'll look at something like Dexter's Laboratory. That's Craig McCracken's, or was that Genndy Tartakovsky?
That was Genndy Tartakovsky.
Genndy Tartakovsky.
Craig McCracken did Powerpuff Girls.
Powerpuff Girls. I got them mixed up. But these were like animators with their own vision. These were their shows. Prior to that, it was all properties. It was all the studio. It wasn't really... creator-based, and after the Ren and Stimpy show, creators got a lot of their work sort of put on the screen, and that's when Hanna-Barbera stepped in. What were the four? There was Dexter's Lab, there was Powerpuff Girls,
there was Johnny Bravo, and then
Ed was the fourth one.
Was that at the beginning?
I think that was right at the beginning. Okay.
Well, the other one, I'm just going to throw this out there because nobody talks about this show, and this show made me laugh so hard, and it's right in the middle of that, between Saturday Morning Cartoons and the Cartoon Network. But they ended up airing on the Cartoon Network. Two Stupid Dogs.
Oh, I never saw Two Stupid Dogs.
Two Stupid Dogs was a very funny show. It was about two stupid dogs, one of whom talked very slow, one of whom like moved around really fast as a big, sort of a little yappy dog. Mm. And it was great. And they also had a second segment in every episode, which was a sequel to Secret Squirrel called Super Secret Secret Squirrel.
Oh, God.
Which was also pretty funny and had like some good Danger Mouse vibes to it. If you ever get a chance to see Two Stupid Dogs, there's some funny episodes of those. Apparently, at the time, it was considered kind of a ripoff of Ren and Stimpy, to which, and I just saw this online, Hanna-Barbera CEO at the time, Fred Siebert, said...
Yes, it was.
Well, he said, that's like Pearl Jam worrying about being compared to Nirvana. And I'm just like, what?
First of all, I think you're asking for Soundgarden. As Beavis once said, maybe they came first and Pearl Jam ripped them off.
Always bothered me that Stone Temple Pilots said, everyone said they sounded like Pearl Jam.
No,
they don't. Scott Weiland sounds like Eddie Vedder. I'll give you that. They have very similar vocal qualities. Musically, they're very different bands.
Fair.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess the when you go back to like the really early, early days of Hanna-Barbera, like the early Tom and Jerry, I really like the animation on those early ones. Just because it
Tom
is
and Jerry's
a little...
Tom and Jerry was MGM.
Oh, I guess it was in the early days. Hanna-Barbera, I think, ended up taking them over.
No, because they had the Hanna-Barbera, they got their start doing stuff like Huckleberry Hound and Quick Draw McGraw.
Yeah, all of like that generation of cartoons were things that were just sort of drifting past my eyeballs as a youth, and I never really enjoyed them.
They weren't that funny.
Yeah,
I guess Quick Draw McGraw had some funny bits, but like not really.
I admire some of the projects they did. I remember liking a special they did called Laugh Olympics. Okay. I think Hanna-Barbera Animation also did the animated film version of Charlotte's Web, which I enjoyed.
Oh, was that the?
That is a good movie.
Well, I'm looking at their films here.
Some of their TV stuff, especially throughout the 1970s.
Look like that was them, actually.
It should get a little credit just for being as wild as it was. They could do things like, it's the Globetrotters, but they have superpowers now.
Yeah.
It's the Partridge
Family, 2020 AD.
The distant future. That was
their gag for a lot of things, just throw them in the future.
Gilligan's Island, but they're in space.
Did you remember when they did Laverne and Shirley, but they're in the army and the Fonz is the mechanic?
Yes.
What the fuck were you thinking? That's how did you pitch that?
Yeah,
my God.
Here's Jabberjaw. Remember Jabberjaw?
Jabberjaw was that whole, like, just, hey, get a bunch of teenagers and one weird talking thing, and then we'll have them solve mysteries. So there was Jabberjaw.
But it's like in
there
the was future the, underwater. Like, it's this weird setting for Jabberjaw.
Jabberjaw was weird. There was the one with what was it, like the Groovy Ghost or something?
Groovy Ghoulies?
No, not Groovy Ghoulies. There was a ghost who was like super hip, and he helped teenagers. Listen, teenagers needed a lot of help solving mysteries, and no actual adults were available, so you had to get the supernatural people to do it.
I think it wasn't until they got a little ironic and self-aware in the 90s that Hanna-Barbera really started to take off, and that's when they took a really crappy show like Space Ghost, about a ghost that's in space and it's a superhero, and gave him his own.
The original Space Ghost was okay.
Pardon?
The original Space Ghost had some fun monsters. It's better than Birdman. The original shows.
The original Birdman, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember they used to show a lot of these old ones, and it was clearly meant to like capture a stoner audience. Like, there was a series of cartoons about two little kids who teamed up with Moby Dick, the whale.
I forgot about that. There was. That was stupid.
Hanna-Barbera made a superhero show about Moby fucking Dick.
They sure did.
And the little kids called him Moby, and Moby like stopped spy submarines and shit. Yeah,
Moby, there was a two-parter. It was Moby Dick and Mighty Mitor. Because Moby Dick can't carry his own show. You gotta throw in another robot.
And here's the weird thing. No Captain Ahab. That's the logical thing. He's
like,
you're
the bad guy, right? Like, I'll get you, Moby!
It's like, you've destroyed my whole body. I'm an android now with a human head. You know, whatever it is. Mixed in with that crowd was Space Ghost, this really ridiculous cartoon character. And I think they kind of realized at some point that these characters are ridiculous. Only stoners are watching them. This is appealing to like older Gen Xers.
And
that
they
kids.
Finally leaned into that.
So yeah, they leaned into that. They said, we're going to take these lame characters that are really awful and we're going to give them like spin-off shows in the 90s. So Space Ghost became Space Ghost Coast to Coast, one of the best cartoons ever made.
Some of it's aged badly, but like the idea was hilarious.
It is unbelievably absurd. This show, because it's not just Space Ghost hosting a talk show,
which is funny in and of itself. He's also like forcing two of his supervillains as like their community service to be like his band and his producer, which is pretty fucking funny.
Zorak and Moltar, they would have real celebrities on. They'd appear on like a little screen in the animated frame.
And they would interview the celebrities, but then they would mix up their answers and write new intros to whatever they said. So that some of them would sound like assholes.
Well, not just that. Often they would just say weird things. They didn't really interview celebrities so much as they did weird things in front of them.
Yeah.
It's like, contort your body, Weird Al Yankovic.
Remember when they had Bjork on, but instead of interviewing Bjork, they said it was Space Ghost's wife?
Yeah.
And she was his wife calling him from home, and he was like kind of embarrassed, like, oh, I regret my marriage. Like, it was just so fucking weird.
In one segment, they got Ashley Judd was going to be their big thing, but they got so distracted, just sort of bickering amongst themselves. She didn't come on until like the last 10 seconds of the show.
Yeah.
And she said one thing. She said, I can bake really good chocolate pies. And that was the only thing there for Ashley Judd.
Ashley Judd was a good get at the time.
Yeah, she was
a huge star in the 90s.
Huge movie star in like 1995. Yeah, and they got her on the show, and all she said is, I can bake really good chocolate pies. Yeah. I believe that about Ashley Judd.
Yeah.
I don't know what they were asking her, what the conversation was. That's
great. Anyway,
so maybe that's my answer. My favorite Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
The early Cartoon Network stuff. Yeah, there you go. All right, we should move on. But thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. These are amazing.
And thank you for Cutthroat Island. And that's so cool. Thank you for Pazuzu's Wings. That's wonderful. Thank you.
You don't have to send us stuff. We like getting it, but you don't have to send us stuff. Your letters are enough for us. Yeah. Thank you.
Speaking of letters, let's move on.
Let's move on to some emails.
Here is a letter. Yeah, and then we're on to email. No more crinkles paper. I can still crinkle a paper, but these are emails. This is a letter from RJ. Hello, RJ.
Hi, RJ.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, in this economy.
Cute.
Firstly, I just finished listening to your Iron List about the best movies that begin with the letter E, and you missed out two of my favorites, and I'm gonna yell at you.
That's fair.
My number one, and I don't think either of you even had this in your honorable mentions, would be Tim Burton's Ed Wood, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. I did mention Ed Wood, actually.
You did mention Ed Wood? Okay, well, I meant to, and I fucked up.
Ed Wood and Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite movies of all time. I also would have included Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but otherwise it was a great episode and maybe my favorite of all the shows you put out.
I feel like Eternal Sunshine deserves a second or another watch for me. I haven't seen it in a long time. It hasn't really lingered with me. I get it. I appreciate it, but it didn't really connect to my soul.
A lot of people love it as a romance. The idea is a couple dates, they start hating each other, they break up, and
there's a service that allows you to erase the memory of a bad relationship so that you can move on.
And a lot of it takes place in one of the characters' subconscious as the memories are being erased, so it's all very abstract and surreal.
Yeah.
And there's all other shenanigans besides. People are inserting themselves into people's brains unduly and creating memories. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but at the very end, it's ultimately a romance, and it's about how
they're kind of meant to be.
They're going to fall in love anyway because they were kind of drawn to each other. And I didn't like that. I wanted it to be about the breakup and about the pain. I didn't want it to be about them rekindling.
I kind of wanted to see at the end of the movie, it turns out that they've done this 50 times and they're 90 years old and they just keep doing this over and over and over again. And that would be my ironic set ending where it's kind of sweet, but also really kinda fucking sad. Yeah.
There was a tragic element to that movie,
you can't learn from your mistakes if you don't deal with your memories of something. You know, and the idea is that, maybe they're meant to be together. Maybe it is a mistake.
But yeah,
it's the early parts are great, but then it makes them ultimately unhappy. Mm-hmm. If you don't remember the parts that make you unhappy, you'll just keep doing the same thing. So I feel like that is kind of sad that they're going to end up together again. I don't know.
I haven't seen it since the early 2000s.
I need to rewatch that movie. I need to rewatch that. That's a fair point. I know a lot of people love it. I need to rewatch that movie. I haven't seen it since... shortly after it came out. I've seen it a couple of times.
Anyway, the letter continues. What I wanted to talk about is an extension of a conversation you had in the previous episode of We've Got Mail regarding film characters who are terrible people. The actual question was about double standards between men and women, but eventually just came around to this topic. I just wanted to throw in my thoughts on the matter because, as Bibb says, it can be a complex topic and people will draw their own lines in the sand, so I want to chip in with how I see it.
Okay.
Warning for listeners, some spoilers for Licorice Pizza, Uncut Gems, and Red Rocket.
Okay, so skip ahead if you need to.
For me, the appeal of a really terrible person as a lead character lies in their ability to fail. The two greatest examples I can think of are Red Rocket, which you talked about previously, and Uncut Gems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that these two leads are bad in the same way, but their individual journeys inspire the same feeling in me. I need to see you fall.
Yeah.
Adam Sandler's character in Uncut Gems is a disaster of a person who deserves all the shit he brings his own way, and then the ending is such a chef's kiss.
Yeah.
I'm not keen on the film overall. It's a panic attack. It's really difficult to watch.
I kind of love it, though, but I do. I agree with this whole.
I admire for that.
But, I agree with this whole point, by the way, because the character is terrible, but the movie doesn't love him.
No.
The movie acknowledged he might be interesting. He's worth watching for a while, but the movie has an attitude
and it nearly
that,
makes it out.
That makes it okay for us to watch him because we don't feel like the movie is on his side. The movie might appreciate that he's good at some stuff and respects some of the things that he does, but. The movie is not about how great he is.
I want to see how bad he can get in.
Perfect example.
I'm not keen on the film overall, but it's one of my favorite endings in recent memory.
I'm more fond
of Red Rocket, the Sean Baker film, which was actually more satisfying because I got to spend a good chunk of time with Simon Rex's lead character, and I watched him build things up for himself, worming his way back into his ex's life, using his friends for money and rides, and of course, grooming a teenage girl to get back into the porn industry. His shitty attitudes, hypocrisy, and total lack of self-awareness are what make him amusing as a character, a word that I find preferable to likable in these situations. Amusing. That's a good distinction.
Amusing is a good way. I don't necessarily need to be amused. I just need to be entertained.
Well,
entertained or engaged.
I understand using amusing rather than likable because that means they're entertaining you rather than
I guess
relating to you.
I don't know. I can be horrified as well, like Nightcrawler, for example. Yeah. You know, I think he's fascinated, but I'm not amused. I'm kind of horrified.
And when that comes crashing down for him in the third act, it is fantastic. Whitney mentioned that he heard no discourse for this film, and I think I know why. The film doesn't let him win. It comes to the conclusion that people rationally want from a 40-year-old man attempting to lure a 17-year-old girl into the porn industry, which is total failure.
Yeah.
I think the discussion surrounding Licorice Pizza is a little more complex because Alana, the film's lead, is not immediately set up to be an irredeemable shithead. Her story is a little more complicated, and while I see that makes people uncomfortable about this film, I honestly don't think the film is particularly romantic. Sometimes I think it presents the more romanticized version of the relationship that Cooper Hoffman's character has, but Alana is the lead and going through a quarter-life crisis. She's stuck between moving forward and moving backward. She finds herself tempted by the friendship and potential relationship with Gary, but tries to move herself forward from it in an attempt to grow up, hence her dates with older actors and politicians. She's not nefarious like the lead of Red Rocket. She's just struggling to be an adult, and the immaturity and youthfulness of Gary's friendship pulls her in because she's not content enough to move forward. This is a bad decision, and ultimately deciding to pursue a romantic relationship makes her a bad person. But I think this film is very aware of it. I can't wait to see them fail, and more of a, I really don't want them to, but I'm fascinated to see where this goes. And that doesn't necessarily translate to justification or romanticism. I just got to watch the character in a complicated part of her life choose the wrong path. And that makes me sad, but I appreciate that on a storytelling level. Happy endings are not always the key. And the ending of Licorice Pizza, I think, is melancholic. Ending is the part I actually take most issue with in something like Licorice Pizza, because I even said this when I reviewed it.
And we're going to be talking spoilers here because we already set the stage.
If the film had been a much longer picture about how this this woman and this teenage boy had this very strange vocationally driven relationship, it was a friendship. Yeah. And she was in this quarter-life crisis where she was kind of feeding off of youth, kind of looking backwards.
Yeah.
And it was sort of about how their relationship continued to grow as he became an adult. Mm-hmm. And it took place over many, many years, and we got to catch up with them when they were like in their 50s and 60s. That would have been an interesting story about how they kind of have this interplay and how he initially had romantic feelings for her, and she always said, no, you're a teenager, that's kind of gross. Mm-hmm. That would have been a much more interesting story.
Potentially.
I think Licorice Pizza, in ending the way it did, kind of put a button on what genre the whole film was supposed to be. And that is, this was actually a love story all along.
Yeah, it ends very specifically, and again, spoilers, with her, because her journey throughout a lot of it is complicated, but when it comes to relationships, with the people that we see her attempt to engage with romantically are older men who, it turns out, are either self-obsessed or focused on work, or they're not great partners. They don't actually have anything invested in her. The only person who has something invested in her specifically is Cooper Hoffman's character. And throughout all of the business that they've been through, he's the only one who has been completely interested in her specifically. It's an immature, obsessive love, but it's the only person that she knows in her life who is actually like committed to her in any way. And so when she finally says, okay, fine, I'll be together, and he says, we're getting married, and then the very last shot of the movie is him cheerfully pulling her by the arm while she runs past the screen saying, I love you.
Yeah.
And then credits. And credits with like kind of like cheerful music. Like it's not like it's a melon, it's not like it's sad music saying, uh-oh. That suggests that at the end, the Cooper Hoffman's fantasy that they were meant to be together was indeed positive. You can look at it melancholically, and I would say that this is not a happy ending. But I don't think the movie is presenting it as such, which suggests to me that there is a disconnect between me and the film, and that's something I'm criticizing the movie for, because I think the movie is suggesting that this romance is ultimately, you know, worthwhile. And I don't buy it. The actual text of the film doesn't support it very well. Cooper Hoffman's character is still outrageously immature.
Yeah.
And like, he's weirdly possessive,
when,
and
it ends when he's still a teen, and yeah, they haven't.
We don't get that context of like how this is going to work out for them later.
Anyway, there's more to this later.
Anyway, so like that's one. That's why I don't really care for that one. But anyway.
Anyway, this conversation can get exhausting because a lot of people always boil it down to depiction is endorsement or art isn't supposed to be pure, when the fact is it's a lot more nuanced than that, and whether whatever rationale you apply to any film does not apply to every film.
Exactly.
There is no one-size-fits-all response for this topic, especially when you consider the kinds of experiences and worldviews some people have in their approach to cinema. For instance, I and a lot of other people would agree that the central relationship in 50 Shades of Grey is pretty toxic and abusive.
Agreed.
But presented as desirable and romantic. However, there is a critic I follow who gave it a five-star reviews to all three films, and having been in an abusive relationship himself, felt that the film's depiction of abusive relationships was sensitive and accurate and done really well overall. To my mind, that's absolutely crazy, but his experiences aren't mine, so I'll never have that particular lens to see it. That's not necessarily comparable to the films I talked about before this, but a broader point on the discussion. Anyway, I wanted to throw that one into the conversation and see what you guys think. Hope you're all doing well. Sincerely yours, RJ.
That's an interesting point, and sometimes the perspective that we have on particular works of art is deeply personal. Mm-hmm. I know that there are films that deal with very serious topics like abuse or sexual assault, and that some people find incredibly distasteful are sometimes to people who have experienced those things viewed through a different lens.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're worse than people thought or better. And those are all valid. This is the reason why, one of the reasons why we say everyone's a critic is we need everyone's perspective to get a full picture of things. Just because Whitney and I may feel a certain way about something and present our opinions with some confidence doesn't mean we're right. Mm. This is just how we feel. This is our perspective, and we try to support that as best we can so that you can understand where we're coming from.
Yeah.
We also want to understand where you're coming from, and that we may not move over to your side. Sometimes we do.
No,
sometimes
yeah,
you make an excellent point, and we're like, oh, shit, that's a great point. Thank you. Mm. Sometimes it just doesn't work out. But in any case, it's all very complicated. And when you're dealing with deeply personal issues, moral issues, some people are going to respond unfavorably to movies that they don't feel are being very responsible. I react this way myself. I try to make it clear when I'm doing that. Mm. I'm not saying necessarily the movie is incompetent. I just feel like it's gross in some way, and I don't react to it well, so, but there you go.
There was a film a film that came out like I think it was 2 years ago that I ended up giving a pretty positive review to and have gotten a lot of grief for.
What's that?
And it was on Netflix. It was called Cuties.
There was
a bit of a controversy around this film, Cuties, because of its advertising.
Yeah.
The film is about young girls. It's about 11-year-old girls who are growing up in pretty dire circumstances. And it's based on the filmmaker's sort of own experiences as a young girl.
Yeah.
And how there was a little bit of freedom that they could find in this world that was kind of driving them to this dance competition where they were clearly being exploited. They were being sexualized by the people who were holding these competitions. And they were just sort of rolling with it and like sort of finding it really empowering without kind of knowing themselves what sort of unsavory ends it was fulfilling. A lot of people, sight unseen, thought that this film was advocating the behavior in the movie.
The exploitation.
The exploitation. They thought it was an exploitation movie that was just deliberately sexualizing young girls. That's what the movie's about. It's clearly not advocating for that. In fact, I think it's very sensitive and open. And I think a big issue that a lot of people failed to acknowledge was that it was biographical, that this is actually a really important topic for the filmmaker. Let me look up the director's name, because it was based on her experiences.
Yeah.
Because I gave that a good review, I got a lot of grief for people who thought I was advocating the exploitation of children, because they thought it was an exploitative movie. It's not. It's actually a very nuanced, complex film about a young girl's experiences with sexuality and having it thrust upon them. We live in a very sexualized world. You see it a lot in advertising, a lot on videos, a lot on Instagram. And what is it like being an 11-year-old, being raised in those circumstances? I think the film is really sensitive and intelligent in the way it approaches those things. Is it about negative things? No, it's not. Maimouna Doucouré is the name of the director. It's a French film.
Yeah.
I think the instinct to judge a film for the content you read off of a synopsis is really tempting, and it's not going to get into the nuances of what that film is about until you see it. So I think a lot of what people are reacting to are actually first impressions rather than the film that they've seen.
Yeah.
All right.
Fair enough. It's complicated.
It's a bit of an issue, and art conversations about art, especially the art created about controversial things or bad things in the world, can cause a little bit of controversy, especially if it's sensitive to you, or it covers a topic that you don't, covering an experience you haven't had.
Yeah. All right, we should move on. I think we have time for one or two more.
Here's a letter from Thomas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Thomas.
Good evening, name redacted and name redacted. I didn't want to assume. I got a new job.
Oh.
Congratulations.
Congrats.
And was sent for training for 3 weeks out of state. It's my second night here in my extended stay hotel, and after thinking of what to do, I decided to turn on the TV. I haven't had cable in 6 years. Oh, let me guess. You landed on Chopped or Law and Order?
I have a story about this.
Anyway, I flipped through the channels and I landed on Gone in 60 Seconds, the remake. Mm-hmm. And my heart skipped a Cage beat, and I watched the whole thing. Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you dudes, are when was the last time you channel surfed? And what three movies that you see during a surf would you have to stay on? The caveat to these questions is what channel would you be watching during the show? I hope this makes the show. I have 19 days left here and I am lonely. Well, I think we're in that window. Signed, Thomas. Channel surfing isn't really a thing anymore because TV's on demand.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, when you even if like you do have cable and you want to see what, oh, well, it's just playing. The thing I was watching is over. Is there anything else on right now? I just feel like putting on something. You have guide buttons and they'll tell you what's on every channel and you can just press a button and you'll go to that. So you're not necessarily just going to go randomly to every station. You can, but it's not necessarily the way that people consume that media now. It used to be you actually had to physically go to every channel to see what was on that channel.
It's been a little bit frustrating to my 7-year-old son explaining to him that TV was just constantly running, whether it was on or off. There were like 8 channels and they were constantly putting out shows and you could turn it on and see what was going on at that moment. And if you turned it off, you missed it. And my son, who's only been raised on on-demand television, couldn't quite fathom that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the way TV was. That's the way cable was. You were just sort of flipped through channels to see what was on. If you didn't have a TV guide, you didn't know what was on. You just kind of chanced on it. Sometimes you'd discover something. Often you wouldn't. And this was the experience for someone like me who didn't have cable TV.
Yeah.
Going to a hotel. If I ever had to stay at a hotel, they did have cable TV. And they had much more exciting shows.
Yeah.
And that's how I discovered stuff like Tales from the Dark Side. And all those horror shows in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah.
Now we go into my wife and I go into a hotel room. We take bets as to see how many flips it takes before we land on either Chopped or Law and Order.
Nice.
It's never more than 3.
Especially Law and Order, I find. Yeah. We actually, my partner and I, we went on our first proper vacation in over a decade this last week. And we did stay in a hotel and they did have cable. And yeah, at the end of you do a couple of things in the area at the time, you have a few adventures. And at the end, you just kind of want to unwind. And for me, the things that we always end up on, the one thing we tend to end up on all the time is Golden Girls reruns. All
right.
That's almost always on at some point. So those are always pretty reliable. But the other things that we ended up on this time around were, turns out there was an entire station dedicated to Baywatch, like nothing but Baywatch reruns. So I watched some of that. There was an entire station dedicated to the original series of Doctor Who before the Christopher Plummer reboot. So we watched some of the First Doctor, the Third Doctor.
Christopher Plummer was on Doctor Who?
Not Christopher Plummer. Christopher Eccleston, sorry.
Thank you for catching me.
The Christopher Eccleston, Russell T. Davies reboot.
He could have been, I don't know.
No. Christopher Eccleston was the first Doctor Who after they brought it back after the initial cancellation, and then there was that one TV movie with Paul McGann. But they had like the episodes of the First Doctor, the Third Doctor, the Fourth Doctor, and they suggested that they had all of them, but those are the only ones we saw. So those are really, really fun. And also Svengoolie
Oh, you saw Svengoolie.
Svengoolie's still on TV. Oh, Svengoolie's on MeTV. And we actually just mentioned it in, I think, in another podcast. But they were showing Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Oh, that's fun.
So we watched Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman as hosted by the great Svengoolie, who is one of the great local TV horror hosts who has like some real national traction now. And he's on basic cable. So check him out. It's fun.
This is another. Yeah, my wife and I were staying in a hotel. We were in Solvang, California.
Yeah.
Which is a little Danish-themed tourist town.
I've always wanted to go there for Christmas. Mm. They have, like, they really go all out for Christmas. And we were going to go
been there
in 2020, and then shit happened, obviously. So, yeah.
There's a store in Solvang, California called Yule House, which is just Christmas 24/7.
Yeah.
365. It's just, always, you get, if you need a Christmas ornament in July, you can go there. But we were staying in a hotel in Solvang, and we were flipping through the cable stations, and for some reason we got some rogue signal that wasn't even on like the channel guide. That was local TV from Brooklyn.
What?
Clear across the country. It was from Brooklyn. Weird. It was just like some local Brooklyn guys showing some old cheesy movies. We knew it was Brooklyn because we were looking up like the local businesses it was advertising, and it was all these like really lo-fi commercials. And they were stopping occasionally and talking about it, but showing the film Village of the Giants, the Bert I. Gordon movie.
Oh my God,
we stopped and we watched Village of the Giants. Oh, that was a pretty sublime experience.
That's such a bad movie.
Oh, it's wonderfully bad.
Yeah.
Village of the Giants is about teenage juvenile delinquents who swallow a young Ron Howard's growth hormone and become 50-foot giants and take over this little town.
Yeah.
Ron Howard's
Tommy
in it.
Tommy Kirk's got to stop him.
Tommy Kirk has to stop him.
Beau Bridges plays the main bad guy.
That's right. Ron Howard's the little kid.
There's this weirdly intense theme music for the bad guys that Quentin Tarantino uses the theme music for the opening of Death Proof.
Death Proof, yeah. Bum,
bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum, bum,
bum. Yeah, that was from Village of the Giants.
Oh, my God.
And Tony Basil's in it as well. So, yeah, that was a pretty special experience. That we definitely had to stop for that. I don't know if there's a way to recreate channel surfing anymore.
You have to do it. You just actually have to press channel up and down. That's all you have to do. You have to go out of your way. It's not the natural thing to do.
Yeah.
I guess that's basically it. Because with streaming services, it's not really available. The one thing I like, there's a thing Shudder does. And I can't think of another streaming service that does it.
The Shout Factory's channel does this as well.
Okay. Shudder and Shout Factory, I guess. When you put on their streaming service, the first thing they take you to isn't the main menu. They're constantly showing just something live.
What's on their channel.
So, like, you just come in and then, boom, it's a scene from Tourist Trap. And, like, oh, then all of a sudden, you find yourself watching Tourist Trap. Which, if you haven't seen Tourist Trap, oh, my God, watch Tourist Trap. It's such a fun movie. You think you know exactly where it's going, and then it doesn't do that. It goes in a very weird direction. But, like, yeah, it just all of a sudden, oh, Society is on. Well, I'm going to watch the end of this. You know? So that's always fun, and I actually do like that. But, yeah. We have time for one more letter.
Okay.
Let's do one more.
All right. Let's see.
I think you can do it, Whitney. I believe in you.
I'm just trying. Here's a letter from James. Hello, James.
Hello.
This says, Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I've been listening to since the B-Movies days.
Wow.
When I first saw your podcast title, with E being a much more unusual starting letter for films, I took the time to think of my own list of films that I admire.
Oh, our list of the best films to start with the letter E.
Start with the letter E. I'd like to cross off everything mentioned in your podcast and still came up with a 10 best myself.
Awesome.
Well,
I can't wait to hear it.
I have, dare I say, even better than your list.
What?
Without further ado, let's get to it. Early Spring. Okay, yeah, your list is already better than Early Spring by Ozu. Magnificent and beautiful, touching dramas. As much of Ozu's work as yet, this remains my favorite. Endlessly watchable, and when I was a teenager, it used to be aired on afternoon TV regularly here in the UK in the 2000s. Pure comfort food cinema and remains in my personal top 10.
They never just randomly aired non-English language movies in America. Like,
we had
never.
Like UHF stations. That's where I saw like Gamera movies and Luchador films.
I'm talking about like network television. You would never just see that in an afternoon. Yeah, I honestly can't think of a single one. Maybe Godzilla. Godzilla would occasionally pop up on, like, Saturday midday.
But they were dubbed. They were always dubbed in it.
That's true. They were dubbed. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Edward II, Derek Jarman. Never read any of Marlowe's work, yet this subversive pro-LGBT anachronistic adaptation has stayed with me since, challenging yet deeply compelling. Have you seen Edward II?
No, I haven't.
It's on Ovid.
I've seen Jarman's The Tempest. Which I wish I liked more than I did. I respect it, but I didn't actually enjoy it very much. But yeah.
All right. Eve's Bayou by Casey Lemons.
Oh,
one of the most important films in African American cinema. Unfortunately overlooked today, and also featuring a career best from Samuel L. Jackson. Eternity in a Day by Theo Angelopoulos.
Okay, now you're just showing off. Come on. You're showing off.
If you're cracking out Theo Angelopoulos.
No. And I don't mean that derisively or condescendingly. I'm not saying you don't believe this. What I'm saying is you're showing that you're better than us. So it's, and you are.
Just have better taste.
You are. You're better taste than us. It's fine. Yeah.
Perhaps Angelopoulos' most conventional film, yet it remains one of his best. An exploration of the inevitability of death with an amazing Bruno Ganz in the lead. This film can stand in the ring with Kurosawa's Ikiru and possibly win. I need to see Eternity.
Apparently. Yeah.
And, Embrace of the Serpent. We were just talking about this
I should have mentioned that.
Different podcast.
I should have mentioned that.
Yeah. The second best film of 2015 has reached the list, second only because it was against the current god of cinema, Hu Hsiao-hsien, who released The Assassin the same year. Hard to go up against Hu Hsiao-hsien.
Yeah.
Yet this is a true work of art. It can join Coppola and Herzog as a great film about going up the river to madness.
Yeah, we have an episode of... Critically Reclaimed coming up later this week, which we just recorded. It'll go up in a couple of days, where we talk about the lost city of Zed. And towards the end of the podcast, I mentioned that I think Embrace of the Serpent handles the same material
better. Movie. Yeah.
So I 100% agree on that. I don't think it would have made my top 10, but it definitely should have made my honorable mentions. Mm-hmm.
8.5 by Federico Fellini.
Oh, well, I'm not
I know fan. You guys aren't Fellini fans, but this film is a joy. Let's not linger on it from apart. Apart from, I recommend Fellini's Satyricon as, it's the best film set in ancient Rome, and Evie Taloni, which is a sweet, gentle experience to change your mind. I've seen Evie Taloni, and I actually like that one. It's William, I think you would like Evie Taloni, because that's like one of the least Fellini movies. It's actually a little bit more like a French film.
I don't want to find... Here's the deal. Fellini's pretty prolific, and I haven't seen everything he's done, and it's entirely possible I'll finally find the one thing that like unlocks it. Like, when you're trying to develop a taste for like something, and like you don't like any beer, and then like you have this one beer, like, oh, okay, this one I like, and now I understand why the other ones are good.
Okay.
Because this one like hit me in a certain way, like that kind of thing. I don't want to... I mean, if it works out this way, it works out this way. I don't want to find the Fellini film that isn't like Fellini, because then it's not going to help me like Fellini. I want to find the Fellini film that is like Fellini that I can still tap into. That's what I'm searching for, because I want to...
If I just don't like him,
I just don't like him, but
like,
if I'm
going to... You haven't seen La Dolce Vita yet, have you?
That's the big one I haven't seen.
Yeah, you should see La Dolce Vita.
That's the big one.
I think you'll like that one, too.
Okay.
Next up on the list is Eureka by Nicholas Roeg, a lesser-known Roeg picture, but one of his best, a true crime story with Gene Hackman and all-star cast. The opening scene of a prospector Hackman hitting it big is clearly an influence for PTA's There Will Be Blood, but this film and that scene are superior.
All right.
Earth, 1930, by a filmmaker named Dovzhenko. I don't know this movie.
I don't know this one.
Yes, I had to Google his name. A powerful portrayal of life on a collective Soviet farm in which it portrays the struggles and humanity of all involved. Perhaps with current events, it can be an excuse for more people to check out this Ukrainian masterpiece, although there's a deep well of other well-known Ukrainian cinema to dive into full of riches. I don't know Earth. It sounds right up my alley.
Sounds cool, yeah.
Next up on the list, Elevator to the Gallows.
Critically Reclaimed. I think we had it on the list and didn't get voted for,
Louis Malle's first and, for me, best film. This classic noir thriller is sharp, short, and entertaining as hell, and features a standout cast and an astonishing Miles Davis score. The score is often the most cited thing about Elevator to the Gallows. Mm-hmm. Strong contender for number one spot. If it weren't for number one, The Ear. Do you know The Ear?
Sounds familiar.
By Karel Kachina. Karel Kachina.
Okay.
This 1970 masterpiece was banned by the Czech communist government until the fall of the Soviet Union, yet it is a miracle it still exists, or indeed got made in the first place. Plot. A member of the government attends a large fancy dinner only to return home with his wife and suspects the house has been broken into. Paranoia of them being under surveillance and strains of their marriage make for a not-so-fun night. To put it simply, it's The Conversation meets Who Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and it's magnificent.
Wow. That sounds cool.
Look that film up, because I want to know where I can watch it.
Hold on. It's The Ear. Was The Ear again? Did The Ear be around there?
Just The Ear, 1970.
Honorable
mentions. Exorcist II, The Heretic. Hey, there's a little bring it back around here to Craig's book here, Craig Farnham's book. I know this may seem like a troll, as it's hardly one of the best films ever made, unlike all mentioned before, but damn, I love this film. It's beautifully made, and upon multiple viewings, I can laugh at it and yet still find depth and compelling material in here. I've ruined all credibility for this rap. thought.
The Ear is currently on the Criterion Channel.
Is it?
You
all
can
right.
watch it. You can watch it tonight when you get home.
I think I just might.
It's only an hour and 34 minutes.
That sounds great. So, yeah. All right, I'll check that out. Thank you so much for the work you gentlemen have done over the last, I think, 8 years. I've been listening, and I look forward to many more. Yours sincerely, James.
James, thank you so much for your recommendations. The ones that I can attest to, spot on, which suggests to me that the films that, with the exception of 8.5, which I'm just not a fan of, that's not your fault, that's me. I assume everything else on your list is as good as those. So, well done. Touché. And thank you very, very much. And if anyone else has any other movies that begin with the letter E that we missed, let us know. It's half the fun of it. We like to share these things. And that's it. That's it for We've Got Mail. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. Thank you, everyone, who sent us stuff. That was really cool of you. If you want to write in for a future episode, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And Whitney, what is our P.O. box? Yes. If anyone wants to send us stuff would just like to send us a letter or a postcard or whatever.
We're not requesting stuff.
No, it's you're just not a letter, send us stuff. It's nice that people
it's
do.
It's generous and sweet, and we really appreciate it. Yeah, send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. And, what am I supposed to add to that? We'd love to hear from you. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. It means the world to us. If you want more of our stuff, don't forget to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We just added and changed a few things on there. It's still mostly the same. The big differences are that every tier, even at $1 a month, we're offering all of these regular episodes of our show, Critically Acclaimed, We've Got Mail, Critically Reclaimed, The Iron List, the stuff that you can normally get for free. We're offering that without ads. So if that's really important to you, for $1 a month, you can get them without ads. Or for any of our other tiers, you also get a bunch of other stuff as well, depending on what tier you're at. We've got shows dedicated to every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, every single episode of Star Trek. We do commentary tracks. And at our top tier, we have a new perk where we're doing trivia nights. You can test your mettle against me and or Whitney, depending on whose schedule is most available at the time. So... first one of those is coming up in a couple of weeks, just here in May. Look forward to seeing everyone there. It's going to be a blast. So thank you, everybody, once again for joining us. Special thank you to all of our patrons. If you want to talk to us any other way, of course, we're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I myself am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibel.
We hope you have a wonderful week. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.